Hello. Thank you for coming tonight on this really, really cold night to the Travis Morford Lecture. And I'm very, very, very honoured to be here tonight to give it to you. I want to talk about my time at Farn, but I also want to talk a little bit about how I came to be standing on this stage. And I hope that some of the things I say will make sense to you. And I hope at the end, if you feel free, if you'd like to ask me questions, I'm really happy to answer them. So McLeods. This was Andrew and me at a celebration for McLeods' 200th episode. As is the way with most network shows, this was our eighth series. We'd made 224 episodes, and there were so many stories in that show. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to start the lecture tonight, showing you that clip, because story has been my whole working life. And I've been paid for making stories up, words, pictures, music, and all three together most of the time. I want to show you that image. That image for me is the heart of McLeods. That was one of the last stills ever taken on the set. It must have been one of the last sunsets we ever had. And I'm still moved by that image because that's the heart of the story. And I'll tell you a little bit about it a little bit later. But, you know, McLeods even had a story department, as most series do, and I love that, by the way. When I first heard the term, it seemed such an unlikely thing. You know, you can think of sanitation department, you can think of education department, but story department. You know, education, sewerage, planning, these are solid and worthy things, but a story department, that seemed magical to me, nutty but magical, that you could spend time officially making up stories, being paid for it. These days, as Tony would have indicated probably to you, I'm an agnostic about the transmission medium of a story, TV, film, books. I'm now going to show you what I've been doing recently with my books. I'm now going to show you another clip. Roll it. That was the cover that the book was published under last October. And this, they're just about, it's coming out in this new smaller format now in shops. So these days, after so many other kinds of screens, the screen that I use most is the screen on my computer. And I write. My words kind of drop out of the ends of your fingers. And I work alone, or almost so. And I didn't know if I could do that. I really didn't when I started, write all by myself. I'm gregarious to a point. But I surprised myself. I found out, and who knew, that I also really enjoy silence and my own company. And about the most dramatic thing now, when I write, is the weather. We live at Cygnet, and this is what I see when I write. 14 hours a day in the maelstrom of television production for years without count, well, that's what it seemed like sometimes, had not prepared me for the discovery of solitude. But life is risk. It may not seem like that, but it is. And I think risk is good. It shakes you up. It puts you in the path of things you do not expect. And it asks you to cope. And nothing prepares you for that true discovery. Because as long as you live, your life will not be static and you will try new things and you're just as likely to fail as succeed. And when I started writing, I had no idea whether I could make it work. I had no idea. I'm not a novelist, or I hadn't been a novelist. My mother was a novelist. Her last book, by the way, From Sarah to Sarah, S-A-R-A-H to S-A-R-A, was launched at this school when my mother was 87 years old, 10 years ago, when my niece Sarah Graham Evans came to this school. My mother's first books had been published in London when she was 23. She'd had three published between the ages of 23 and 26, and her last book was published when she was 87. It ain't over till it's over. And it's a long adventure for me. True discovery is the point, I think, of anybody's life. You go somewhere that you've never been and you don't know the rules, and that's what true risk is. For most of the time, perhaps, life can seem routine, certain, set goals to work towards, a safe place. in which to explore. And that's good. That teaches you discipline, gives you a sense that you're getting somewhere safely, and you can see the end, possibly, of that road from where you stand. But all my life, even at Farn, I've been drawn to the chaos of creative pursuit, and it is chaotic sometimes. I've always wanted to see what was at the other side of the mist. I've always wanted to see what was at the end of the road I hadn't walked down. This is a photograph by a Swedish photographer who's in her 80s. Her name is Kirsten Klein. She's famous in Sweden. I didn't know that when I saw this image. I saw it in Prague when I was over there researching locations for the first three novels, the medieval novels. This is a road in bogland Donegal. Now, that landscape may horrify you because it's grey and it's cold and it's misty and there's not a person to be seen and there are no buildings. But I look at that and I get on that road, and sometimes when I write, I can see myself walking down that road. To me, that's the writer's road, because I don't know what's at the other end. And when I write my books, it's so unlike television plotting. I don't know the story. I wait for the story and the characters to find me. It's what I find exciting, the unknown. And I love surprises, I really do. They test me. It's hard sometimes, but risk gets my blood up. And whoever it was who said, make what you love your job and you'll never work a day in your life, was right. Always, television, film, writing, music, I've done what I have done, and I would have done it for nothing. I've always felt like that. When we made the clip for The Dressmaker, we had about $200 and three people. And I hadn't directed anything for 20 years. But I really wanted to do it. And in a one-day shoot, working with the best in the best, I called in every favour I could lay my hands on. We made that clip. And I had such a good time. But I could have fallen flat on my face. Anyway, it's been seen in lots of places now, which I like. And I like the clip of The Dressmaker. I'm shameless about that. So the best piece of advice, I think, that was ever given to me was, would you do this, even if you weren't being paid? If that's a big yes, and it was for me, then you're on the right track. And that brings me to luck. Okay. Bet you don't know who this is. I don't think she went to Farn. So I think of myself, and always have, as a lucky woman. But Oprah says, luck is preparation meeting opportunity. Preparation meeting opportunity. Sometimes you don't know what you're preparing for. Preparation meeting opportunity. And you can say what you like about Oprah. She's been a phenomenon. 25 years at the top of her game. Respect. And whether you agree or disagree with how she spent the last 25 years of her life in our faces, she just might be right on this occasion. You know, I think you can influence your own luck by saying yes much more often than you say no. I mean, you've got to be a bit careful who you say yes to, but mostly, if someone offers you an opportunity, please say yes. Don't walk away wondering. You test yourself, it seems to me, against your fears by doing something you didn't expect you could. One of the things I don't do it that often now, but I used to do it quite often, and it might seem like quite a cheesy thing to do, but it's had the strangest effect sometimes. I write fan letters to people I admire. I write to other writers whose books I've read that I really love, because writers are readers and readers are writers. I wrote to Michael Hirst. There were two films that starred Cate Blanchett. The first one, Elizabeth, was just called Elizabeth, made Cate Blanchett's name. It was written by Michael Hirst. And then he did Elizabeth, The Golden Years. And then there was this, I think, one of the most perfect historical series of all time, The Tudors, that starred Jonathan Rhys-Meyer, who's sadly just tried to commit suicide. So that tells you something about the life of an actor, if you've played Henry VIII, as he did. Anyway, I wrote to Michael Hirst after I saw The Tudors go to air because I thought it was perfectly made. I couldn't fault it. And I'm the world's worst audience. If I sit in a film or watch TV, I'm too impatient to watch it mostly. I rarely surrender to the story because it creaks for me and it doesn't move fast enough or it moves too slow or whatever the hell. So I wrote to Michael Hirst and I told him what a magnificent piece of work I thought it was. And he wrote every episode of The Tudors, and they did, I think, 5 series, and, you know, maybe they did 9 or 10 episodes in every series. That's 50 hours of writing, 50 hours of television writing. And you don't just write one draft. You probably write effectively 3 or 4. And if you're writing every script, you've got the production office at your back harassing you to give them the next pages. That is a mighty, mighty achievement. And the quality stayed there all the time. So you like to get compliments. You like to hear it when someone likes what you've done or said or looked like. I think everyone likes that, especially because anybody involved in the creative industries is so insecure. You never know whether anything is going to work. Every time you begin again. The fact that you may have had success in the past means nothing. You may not have success again, and you know that going in. So if you see something, a film, an actor, a book, write to them. Just tell them how much. It just makes such a difference, especially if you're having a bad day. I'm sorry, I've lost myself. Anyway, I think you test yourself against your fears. Helping yourself to become lucky, you test yourself. And when times are tough, there's that great British wartime slogan: this is the best thing you can do for yourself. Keep calm and carry on. Just put one foot in front of the other when you're tested. That's not bad, and it's hard to do, very hard to do quite often. Julia Gillard right now must be finding keeping calm hard. Nick McKim tonight must be finding keeping calm hard. But if Julia lasts, for instance, that will tell us a great deal about her, not just as a woman, but as a prime minister. And she might stick around. She might be the first of many. I would be so sad if Julia Gillard was our first and only Australian prime minister to be a woman and we didn't get another one for another 20 years. I think that would be devastating. So, Julia works for the Australian people. All the politicians do. You may not have noticed this. Once they leave school or further study, most people work for someone or something. But when you work for yourself, and you don't have to, by the way, I guess I found out that I wanted to roll that dice, you have some chance of controlling your destiny. Don't be fooled, though, only some chance. Statistically, most businesses, especially small businesses, fail in the last 2 years. Andrew and I, with Millennium Pictures, our production company, came so close to going under in the early years of production. We nearly lost the house twice, and in Sydney, where are you going to live? The gutter? God. Nearly lost the house twice because of deadlines. We had to roll productions without finance properly in place. Now, high five, you see, all McLeods. When you roll a production, you start the biggest taximeter in the world running. Because every day on production, you've got people in the production office, you've got people in the art department out there. Art department, that's another good thing, as well as story department. You've got the writers, you've got the post-production people, you're designing the titles. Money is just flowing out the door, and you've got to pay them. That's terrifying. That's so terrifying, that kind of risk. But if you survive, fear is bracing. And it can be a truly powerful motivator for changing your luck. Fear of failure was always one of the big fears that I have had. I'm still scared of failing. You know, new book comes out. Will anybody buy it? I don't know. Now, I reckon some people respond to risk and fear by never sticking their head over the parapet like they did in World War I. That can be sensible because as soon as you draw attention to yourself in that way, doing something no one else is doing, there may be a chance you'll get it shot off. No one, when we pitched that as we did, if anybody, I don't know if this survived into the Wind broadcast tonight, we did a little piece at the school with a couple of us, and I said we pitched High Five as Spice Girls do education, and we did, because Spice Girls were huge when we did the pilot in 1998. But no one had ever done it before, and we didn't know if it would work. And it's said that Australians like to cut the heads off tall poppies, and I think there's something in that. We're still, I think, quite conservative in Australia. We don't necessarily like success. We like being a group. We don't like people to stand out from the group. And we're so old-fashioned that still, on the boards of the major 200 companies on the ASX in this country, I believe the statistic is 2% of women sit on boards. That's disgraceful. Half the human race, the people who buy things, who control the family finances pretty much, and there's 2% of the decision makers on the national company boards. I still don't get that. I really don't. Anyway, I think failure is a necessary part of life. If you fail, the good thing is it will be your failure. Fail more, fail better. That's what Einstein said. And if you're on the right track, you do improve if you get up off the floor. In the end, keep getting up off the floor enough times, and I guarantee you, you'll outlast everybody else, and you will win. And I'm a very competitive person. I really like to win. I wish I was not that way, but I'm built that way, and I reckon it's genetics. Maybe it was fun. I don't know. And there's nothing like a real win to shut the witless crowd up. They may be jealous, but they do shut up. And you've done it. You've done it because you've done what they were too frightened to do, what they often talk about, but maybe don't do themselves. By the way, if you do go into the creative industries, any of you in this room, and you get to the point where you're getting reviews of your work, don't read the bad ones. Your friends will tell you that you've had a bad review because the ones who care about you will not want you to be hurt, and the ones who aren't quite like, are more like frenemies than friends, will be delighted that you've got a bad review. Don't read them. Don't read them. Only, you don't want that stuff in your head. Only read the good reviews. Don't let mean-spirited opinions question your worth. Never do that. We're so, I think, sweeping statement coming up, warning. It may be that women are more conscious of other people's opinion of themselves. And women, it seems to me, work most comfortably in groups. And the good opinion of the group is very important to women. But in the end, I think you have to choose. Because if you want to do big things, not everybody's going to like you. But it doesn't mean you have to listen to them. That's what I think. Keep at least 3 good reviews, by the way. And on the bad days, take them out and read them. They'll make you feel better. When you chance your arm and going on, and you go on doing that, you need something to bolster your strength and your belief in yourself. That's because you can't guarantee on the bad days that anybody else will hold you up. You have to learn to hold yourself up. And that brings me to shamelessness. It's a very, very useful tool. I am utterly shameless. I've learnt to be. I was shy once. I think when I came here, I was sort of 14, and I'd gone to endless new schools, so I was always the one breaking in. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time in the library hiding because I wasn't amongst the coolest group or the whatever. And then I slowly made friends and it was all right. But, you know, you have to overcome that. And for me, that was a big thing. So I was so self-conscious. Fast forward to now, and I know that I will ring anyone, I'll front anyone if I really need to do something. That ambitious part of me has taught me that that's what I need to do. And what's the worst they're going to do to you if you ring up somebody cold or you send them an email cold? Be dismissive? Yes, sometimes. Never reply? Certainly. Be rude? Not often. We're still quite polite, I think, in Australia, especially, by the way, in Tasmania, because this is a kinder place. Help you when you ask nicely for their advice more often than you might think. People remember being young and starting out, the generous people, the ones you want to work with. And, by the way, if you really feel someone's ungenerous, move on. Don't waste your time. You don't want to be influenced by ungenerous people. But the generous people will help you. Might take time to find those kind people. Keep looking. All you need is one. You know, it's priceless. And, I'm probably talking about how to suck eggs, which is no doubt ridiculous. But you need mentors. You need people. you admire and believe in, maybe somebody you've written to. You know, Michael Hirst, when, I mean, I won't say I'm Michael Hirst's closest friend, but I had an interesting exchange of emails with him, and we talked about writing on quite a technical level. I didn't know the man, but I learnt something. So seek out mentors. Don't be afraid to ask. The difference between us and America is that in America they ask. In fact, they batter the door down. Here we're too polite, we wait to be asked. I think I've been helped a lot along the way. And it did start at school. Certainly that was my experience at this school. I had great and generous teachers. You know, they're the teachers. I did come across one or two who understood me, or I felt they did. This noisy creature, once I got my confidence, all sort of whirling arms and legs, talking like a machine gun, they didn't mind. And I think they helped. What you said, Tony, I mean, I can remember writing here. I can remember sitting in the library and writing poetry, writing snatches of words, writing. So something unlocked. And you need, whatever it is you do with your lives, whatever direction you go, that unlocking moment is a wonderful thing when it happens to you. And it will. And you'll know it when it does. That's what I think. I had an English professor at university. He was a great medieval scholar. I ended up babysitting his and his wife's children because I nearly failed first year and I burst into tears in his office. He did his doctorate under J.R.R. Tolkien. He's a man in his 80s now. On runes. 20 years later, after I left university, Ralph Elliott's, that was his name, influence, the way he taught, his love for his subject, which was the thing that influenced me most at that time, was his knowledge, his depth, his passion, his love of medieval literature. And I've always been interested in history, so I was very interested in the era. Anyway, it stayed in my head. You know, at some place in the dark right at the back. And I reckon for that succeeding 20 years, I read around the subject of medieval England history because they're such extraordinary and extravagant personalities, such a bloody time, lawless. But this glorious literature was produced. It was the beginning of the waking up of England. It came out of some long dark sleep. Printing was invented. Books started to become more available, all of that. Anyway, I was very moved by that. And I wrote three books. That's the second one. That's the soppy English cover. So I wrote The Innocent, The Exiled, and The Beloved. And because I was naive, I didn't understand that publishers, you're supposed to have consultation on covers. Well, consultation in Britain, between Britain and Australia, believe me, can become very convoluted, even if you have email. And they saw these in a particular way, these books, and they marketed them in a particular way, and that was the end result. That looks like a romance, a sort of a bodice-ripping kind of romance. There's aspects of that, but it's actually about an alternative version of history. It is a great big sweeping love story, because I like those. That was a really interesting and disillusioning thing, actually, when I saw the British covers for the first time, because I thought they were selling the ideas of the book. I didn't like what they did with them. But what was interesting was after the first, as each of the three books was published, The Innocent first, this one, The Exiled, then The Beloved, I sent copies of the book to Ralph Elliott, who lives in Canberra. And I was very nervous about doing that, because this is a serious, heavy-duty scholar, and I'm not an academic. I'm not interested in writing in an academic fashion. That's not me. And he wrote back to me. The first letter he wrote back to me was like the sun coming up, and I still have that letter because he wrote so graciously, and I think it genuinely moved him that out of the dark had come this letter from this girl who'd babysat their children, you know, maybe 25 years before. And he knew that something of what he had done had landed in my soul. Now, I don't know, maybe he gets like letters like that every day. He might. He was an amazing teacher. But that's not bad. That's why I say, please tell people if you like their work, please, because you'll make them feel so wonderful. They need that. The next book, interestingly, that I'm doing is also comes out of... this is the one that will be published next year, and it's called The Island House. And it's about the discovery of a Viking longship burial on an island off the northeast coast of Scotland. And when I was trying to make up my mind whether to leave Nine or not, and that's covered in Gerald Stone's book, Andrew and I got on a plane and we went to New York because we were showing McLeod's at the New York Television Festival, which was hilarious because they looked at it very politely and I don't think they got it at all. But anyway, and then I decided I needed some time to think. So Andrew suggested we go to Scotland because I wanted to research the setting for this book. And this little village called Pennon is where a wonderful film was shot a long, long time ago called Local Hero. And you, this will be foreign to anybody, to most of the younger members of this audience. For God's sake, get it out. It's called Local Hero. It's the music in it is written by a man called Mark Knopfler, who was in a great band called Dire Straits. It is the warmest, most loving portrait of a place and a group of people trying to do something impossible. It's very moving, and it ends with a mermaid. And you kind of see the mermaid for a minute, and by the time you look again, she's gone, and you don't know if she's a mermaid at all. Anyway, so we went to Pennon, and I nearly drove us off the road that came down those big precipitous cliffs, because as we came down the cliffs and I looked across to the other side, I saw a long, low stone building. And I had seen that building in my head. Now, I might have seen it in a book. I don't know. And I don't have a picture of it. But it was the setting that gave me the book. And then we went further north, and this is in the Orkneys. This is a stone circle in the Orkneys. We travel perversely in winter, Andrew and I, because we both like unpeopled landscapes. And I like going as far north as I can. I haven't been to the Arctic Circle, but I would like to go. So the Vikings went to Orkney, and they plundered the place, and in fact they made it their a winter base. But they never conquered the east coast of Scotland. And going to those two places, and Ralph Elliot and his studies of runes, which he talked to us about, and Beowulf, which he taught us, gave me this book, The Island House, because it's set 1,000 years ago and in the present, and there's not a frock in sight. There's no frocks at all. The Vikings don't do frocks. And I will send him that book. And I hope he's pleased. He'll probably get a laugh out of it. So, I make up stories for a living, and it is a weird job. Out of nowhere, a sense of something turns up, just the kernel of an idea. And you give that something form. You give it a face, you dress it in clothes, you provide it with words. Gradually, a fully formed character steps forward, and you watch fascinated as their world, this fictional world, expands out around them. So this is the original cast of MacLeod's Daughters. And the germ of that idea came from a photograph which I looked for today and could not find. I was devastated by this. I had seen in my head a bunch of ordinary girls, Gillaroos. And then somehow there was something nudging me about that idea and I didn't know what it was. And then in, I think it was the bulletin, I saw a picture of, I said this today to Wynne, but it's true, a bunch of girls, just ordinary girls, hanging over a 5-bar gate. You know, in front of them was cattle milling around and there was dust and there was a big blue sky over their heads and big white grins and shady hats. And that's what came to me, you know, bunch of girls running a cattle station. It's you can see that. It's the simplest thing in the world. And there they are dressed in flesh. And it still took 9 years to get it up on the screen, even after the pilot. You know, I pitched it in 92. We made the pilot, which was shown in 96. The series didn't roll, actually didn't get in front of the cameras till 2001. You know, bloke world, and it still exists and it will for some time. It's a given. You can still win, believe me, if that's what you want to do. Because if I can, you can. I think towards the end I reminded them of their mothers. Mostly I came up to their knees and they knew that I dealt with real people with guns. None of those pussies, pardon me, had ever had guns in their hands. Not really. Not when it really counted. They used to beat their chests and stalk around as if they were Godzilla. Ha! Anyway, I would have put my little dad, 5'6", little blue-eyed Celt, up against any of them any day. There you go, Frank. Anyway, so here they are. So each of the girls in the photo that I originally saw was a story to me. And there was a context for them, this great big farming property the size of a small country. Learning to work with animals in that place, I knew that some of our characters would succeed and some would fail, some would want to be there, some would yearn to run away. They'd be friends, they'd not be friends. The bad times in such an isolated place would test them all. The good times would make them laugh, deepen friendships, provide companionship. And the bad times would show them how to be brave and be themselves, how to be authentic. But the series only slowly emerged. This is one of my favourite quotations. There's this wonderful man called Dr. Livingston, not the explorer. He's written a fantastic book, which I do recommend, which is quite bleak in places, but it contains a great deal of wisdom. It's quite a slender book. I read it on a plane. And the title is Too Soon Old, Too Late Smart. And he says, disaster is the only thing that happens quickly. And I think that time has taught me, my life has taught me that is true. And time has also taught me to pay attention to my instincts, to listen when that voice inside says, hang on. So we did, Andrew and me, we hung on. We would, you know, for all the difficulties of raising money, which is what we were trying to do for McLeod's for nearly 10 years, we didn't let it go. We kept it alive. I think I did 12 individual budgets. We surveyed shooting in, you know, I was going to shoot it in Queensland because we'd get money out of Queensland. You know, then the network wanted us to do it on a studio floor and shoot it in Victoria. I'm so glad we didn't do that. And all the time I wanted to shoot it in South Australia because of that landscape, which had been so rarely seen. And we got there. So, in the end, McLeod's came out of how I imagined, as I said, the lives of those girls might be, the girls that I'd glimpsed in the photograph. Their anonymous faces stayed in my head, though I never knew their names, not in real life. So I did, I gave them names, and they became our characters. And I think that Ellen Gowan, who's the girl in The Dressmaker, who lives in 1840s, 1850s Victorian England, I think she's a cousin of the McLeods. I wrote the book after the series finished, and I didn't see that at first. Somebody else had to point that out to me. I think there are themes in life. There are certainly themes in mine. I know that the things that I'm interested in writing about or putting on the screen are justice, themes about justice, and I think that comes out of living in war zones and being so, I can't tell you. You know, I see the news every night and I see what's happening in the Middle East, as we all do. I see what's happening in Greece. And I think how lucky we are to be here. So themes for me are always, one of the most important ones is justice and fairness and decency and the strength of women. Not just women, women and men, but I'm so impressed with the strength that women exhibit under adversity. You know, not least in wartime, I got an experience of that with my own mother, but I also think one of the reasons I wanted to do McLeod's, because McLeod's was the other side of the story. It was the female side of living on the land. You might think it was romanticised, for sure. You might think they were all impossibly good-looking. Not all of them. You might think that they had a very dramatic life. Definitely. Drama is conflict, you know. We don't make documentaries. We make drama, and that's different. But it was nonetheless my attempt to rebalance the ledger in some way. Yeah. These were things that I... The themes that came up in McLeod's and in the rest of my writing crop up. Cruelty, that's the other thing. I'm very troubled by human cruelty. You know, the history of the world, the history of individual countries, unbelievable. So I don't understand how we can be so cruel to one another. But then I also know that love and persistence and guts are immensely important to us all. And what Ellen did when confronted by the dark side of Victorian London, that's what her story illustrates. By the way, I got to tell you, writing books is different from television because television is a very structured world. And when you open yourself up to writing a book, if you don't plot it and plan it, and that's not the way, as I was saying, that's not the way I work, you open yourself up to the characters taking control. And they do. She did. It was interesting, I'd written two drafts of that book, and at the second draft stage, my editor, whom I really trust, and who understands how to talk to writers and not fill them with complete despair, which is easy to do, nonetheless did say to me at second draft, it's absolutely not working. And I think I've described this before. This was when this book, and it was called Ellen Gowan at that stage, was about that thick. You could have stood on it and got things down from the top shelf. And she said, you have to start again. This book is not working. By the way, you're writing about the wrong person. You should be writing about her. Because there were two women at the core of that book up to the end of the second draft. And she was right. And that was cruel. But anyway, for me, every life is and has a story, a narrative. Everyone sitting in these chairs tonight is a story. A story sitting down, in this case. And that's before we think about where the chairs came from and who made them and what country and how they travelled here and who will sit on them over time. You know, the people who will pass through this room like shadows and on into the future. No one is uninteresting. Nobody in this room is uninteresting. Nobody at the supermarket is uninteresting. And I have stood in Woolies at Neutral Bay, down there, Sandy Bay, and I've wondered, but nonetheless, I still listen to their conversations because I'm fascinated. You know, sure, the odd person might be enigmatic or difficult or loving, embarrassingly so, or fragile, a saint, maybe. I think I've met at least one demon, and I won't name him, but he's a very interesting man. Well, he looked like a demon. No person that you meet is uninteresting, never, ever. However, to capture what makes someone at a supermarket checkout, indelible, for instance, and to be able to show what you found to someone else so that you and they understand their life and your life a little better, that is an art and a craft. And don't be fooled into thinking that supreme talent will excuse you from taking time to learn and practice the craft of what you want to do. I bet people beat you up with this all the time. This is the original cast of High Five. I look at this and I just think what an innocent time it was, 1998. Charlie, the girl on the left-hand side, was 17 when we began. But it's a funny thing about talent, supreme talent. These were all supremely talented. We probably auditioned 500 people to find this five, and they all had to be able to sing and dance and talk to a camera like it was a friend. That's really not easy. Talent takes time to declare itself, and to speak with a coherent voice that other people can actually hear. And the voice is guaranteed to improve with practice. Each one of these original kids in High Five had years and years of singing, dancing, tap, you know, Saturday morning tap classes, performing in everything, as Stedfords, before we cast them. It's true. It's really true. It doesn't matter, though. It doesn't matter if you find yourself mired in what feels like grime, because if there's even the flicker of enough enjoyment to keep you going and you can see yourself getting closer to that breakthrough moment, to where you want to go, that point of a sense that you might arrive somewhere, that it's out there waiting for you, that's the happiness that lies in the heart of anticipation and a definition of happiness. Everyone's obsessed with happiness at the moment. And I don't think happiness is a permanent state, but again, the wonderful Dr. Livingstone said, his version of happiness is someone to love, something to do, something to look forward to. Works for me, and it's easy to remember, and it's testable. I've found personally that the idea of happiness for me has changed. Signet again. For me, it lies in small things. Well, simple things. Not achievements, more like this, vegetables, zucchinis. Now, you know, the big things, the things that the world equates with happiness, pleased me for a very, very long time as they got closer. But They're complicated and they're very demanding to manage. And if I'd said at the Logies, you know what I really want to do? I want to grow zucchinis. People would have looked at me as if I was on drugs. And if I'd said that at that time, no, I wouldn't have been. But anyway, you know, the really big things the world tells you that you want, to be famous, to have lots of money, they're enormously difficult to manage. You might think you want them, and some people in this room will have them both, believe me. When you get them together, watch out. It's like herding cats to keep those two from driving you insane. They certainly distort and warp your view of the world. Don't seek fame and money. Let it come to you. Because that search, if that's all you do, and we see it every night on reality television, is very corrosive. You know, you've been world famous for a minute on whatever the hell, name your show. And some of those people are enormously talented. You know, the So You Think You Can Dance show that was on a couple of years ago. I thought there were some people in there that were amazing. But they've been on the show, they've been famous for a minute, and then they're gone. Because the people who've slogged all the time to get where they get don't welcome people who get instant fame. They want you to earn your dues. It's awful, but it's true. You know, fame keeps receding. It's like a mirage. And for the hungry, a mirage is never satisfying. Heat, as they say in Hollywood, is always a temporary phenomenon. And an aside about Hollywood, a quote, strip away the phony tinsel on top, there's real tinsel underneath. True. In the end, you can only use so much tinsel. It's just decoration. It's nothing more. So, what is your narrative? This got caught up in mine. What in the end will be the story of your life? What will be the themes and the strands, the scenes that will be woven together seamlessly? You'll only understand them, looking back, by the way. You rarely understand them when you're knee-deep in them. Some themes, some scenes you'll acquire or you'll choose, and some will choose you. You began some time ago. Chapter 1, scene 1, first words. You'll live each day, star of your own movie, central character in your own book, right to the moment that time writes the end. And my mum was 97 when she died. That was a long time. But your experience, and this is what you have to give to the world, will be unique. That's precious. No one else will see the world through your set of eyes. No one else will hear precisely what you hear, not exactly, or taste and smell what you taste and smell, or feel velvet or gravel, the way your fingers transmit those sensations to your brain. And how lucky that your story is unfolding here in Tasmania, one of the most fortunate places on earth. Sing it again. Ignore the headlines. Ignore the gloom. Ignore the gloom. Don't think too much about Nick McKim when you go to bed tonight. This is a glorious background for you. It's a great screen for you to write on or paint on or assemble anything against. It's a great launching pad to our little island. What you do will be noticed. It's a small society. Talented people are applauded and supported. Because in a small place, connections between people are strong. People want you to do well. Tasmanians are tremendously proud of Tasmania, proud of what their people accomplish. I'm standing here tonight because you were good enough to be proud of me, and I'm thrilled by that. That was my experience in this very building, not this hall, because it didn't exist. But in this building, I was somehow recognised and I was supported. It gave me, when I left here, very secure ground to stand on when I tried to fly, and that's a scramble metaphor, but it's the truth. When I try to understand my life and my career to this point, I think what I've most often been is an experiencer, because you can make plans. You know, by 22 I'll be in Paris and I'll have made two films and written one book. I've done that. And so you might dream of whatever it is that floats your boat. And you might expect the great trifecta of fame, love, and money to arrive at the same time, and maybe they will, and good luck to you. But life throws stuff at you and you get diverted and you go down paths that you didn't know were there, and some of them are dead ends. Of course they are. And how you deal with those experiences, good, bad, sublime, better, that will make up the narrative of your life. Sometimes it seems to happen so fast you've got no time to think. And that sometimes is be careful what you wish for, because I've been there too. Sometimes it moves so slowly you think, as I have, you'll just die if nothing exciting happens soon. And if you have any control at all, any way of steering what's going on, cling to the things that you feel are most authentic, the things that feel most true to you. I promise you, I reckon you recognise them. I reckon they slap you in the face, to be honest. Because there's a lot of ways, subjective ways, to interpret what's going on in your life. You know, if you think about a car crash, it's a different experience being in the smash to watching it happen. But immediately after the event, interpretation begins, and truth, reality, can change shape and waver. And I think it is the task of a life to understand laboriously sometimes what is true for you in the heart of all your experiences, to actually probably be the person in the crash, not the person being watched. And then to be at peace with yourself. Peace doesn't come easily. Peace is foreign to my nature. I think it's an admirable quality, and I'm a little better at it than I was. But you do achieve peace when you've tested yourself enough to know how your individual's understanding works. And it's storytelling which has allowed me to test my own version of the truth. It's allowed me to wade through confusion and ambiguity and to peel away the layers to find what is solid underneath. Lao Tzu said, and you will have heard this quote, "The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step." And Ben Sweetland also said, "Happiness is a journey. It's that journey. And it's not a destination." And both of them were right. And may the journeys that you are on be long and satisfying and studded with happiness, because you have every right to expect that. Good luck. Of the very best kind to you.
Thank you very much, Posey. And well, just before I officially thank you, I think there may be some questions from the floor. There's an opportunity for people to ask if there aren't any.
Everybody's very polite always.
Yes. I think that's an excellent question. Because I asked you this afternoon, yeah.
Well, you see, I wanted you to see that clip, and if you didn't know that it was a book, I wanted you to ask the question, is it television, is it film? Oh, it's a book. And I can honestly say that I don't write the books to make them, because the difficulties of financing something that's set in another country from Australia, pretty difficult. But I've been watching Downton Abbey, and in a moment of complete lunacy, I've started to think you could make it. And I don't know. I mean, the very thought makes me want to lie on the floor and fan myself. It's just, I mean, that would be the most massive undertaking. And it would be so much money. And as we all know, the world is in a kind of a crazy state at the moment. But thank you for that question. There was one down the back. Well, okay. After McLeod's wrapped in 2008, and we were also given the opportunity to be bought out of High Five in 2008, and we said yes. And we went, and we were then asked to have a joint venture with a company called Fremantle, who make MasterChef, or made the original MasterChefs and So You Think You Can Dance and those big shiny floor shows, because Fremantle bought Grundy's and Grundy's make Neighbours, and that was the only bit of drama. So they wanted to make drama. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the first... So we said yes. And so we joined them on the understanding it was to be for a couple of years, and we were to develop new drama. And the first drama series that I developed was set in Tasmania. I really, 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 really wanted to make it here. I wanted to make it here, and I wanted to make it between here and Melbourne. Again, like South Australia, because the landscape is just never seen, and it's glorious. And we got so close, you know, it took us almost the whole of that year. And then Fremantle had some bust-up spat with Channel 7 and Packed to the Rafters was beginning on air. And then the GFC began to unroll, didn't it? And I see, the thing is, you suffer so much trying to get anything up on television because it's all about raising money and it's tough, that I'd rather try and make epics and not small things. So anyway, that still sits there. I haven't written it off by any... And it's fully developed. I've got, you know, scripts and stories and all sorts of things. And it's come back to us now from Fremantle because that's how the thing was structured, you know, that the things we worked on that we couldn't get up came back to us after a certain period of time. So it sits there. And then I started to develop another whopper that was set in India. And and we gave it a particular title. It's based on a particular classic, the missing years of a particular classic character in literature. And then I had finished, after 6 mortal months working on this hard work, finished it, got all the documents together, sent it off to England, which is where the Fremantle distributors are and all the rest of it, and they would have been taking it to the markets. And we saw announced in Broadcast, which is the British trade magazine, that the BBC had just picked up a series with the same name based on the same character. And after that, that was about 18 months. That was the sort of middle of 2009. And it seemed like a sign. You know, I'd been trundling along with The Dressmaker and I had some part of the Viking book, but not all of it. And, you know, we looked at each other and we'd been working for so long in this industry, and it's very, very, it's all the things it is. And I fell out of love with it. I don't know, I mean, you know, when I think about Making the Dressmaker, I think maybe the love affair's not quite over, but then that's how I felt. And I've been coming backwards and forwards to Tasmania forever because my mother was living down here. And I stayed in a B&B by myself one time coming down to visit my mother down there, and I ambushed Andrew at the end of 1 year. Suckered him into coming down to see my mum just before Christmas, and I'd lined up all these real estate agents. And we saw where we live at Signet on it was the last property of the day, and got to the airport, and I said, I'd like to ring them and say, we'll buy it. And honestly, he'd successfully resisted Tasmania for 20 years. And now we sit on our little ridge line and we can't wipe the smiles off our faces.
Thanks, Rosie. Any more?
Oh,
one last.
Well, one last final thing. There's one last final slide we should put up. I will not get out of this room alive unless we all read that and unless every single farm person in this room enters it. Right there. Have I done my duty?
You've done very well. Look, Posey, look, thank you very much for coming and speaking to us tonight. I feel as though I'm moving out of the bloke world. Really, I am. I do. I think it started when I married and had 2 daughters and moving here to farm. But what you were saying, look, I know creative people like to hear good reviews and feel good, and good reviews make you feel better. I'm sure you're going to get that in spades tonight because we really, truly appreciated what you had to say. So thank you very much.
And
I hope you feel very good about that. It was interesting what you said about luck is really where opportunity meets preparation.
Oprah. Mm.
But, well, that's because... And we've also got a wonderful opportunity. We've got a wonderful opportunity for the girls coming up in their exams, and I know they're going to be well prepared. So as long as they don't... And they're going to have a lot of luck in that. As long as they don't watch too many reruns of Local Hero. Is that the movie you told them
Local
to watch?
Local Hero.
Yes, they should wait till they do that after.
It's an old film, but it's worth seeing.
Right.
Thank you.
But, okay. Now, the other thing is, look, it's been a privilege for us all to see and listen to you tonight. And the slogan the school has been running with recently is Small School, Big Future. And it is fantastic when we have personification of that adage to listen to. And I think that you have certainly personified that adage.
I feel I should curtsy.
No. Now, if you had written the script or this had been your stage direction, this would have worked perfectly. But I have a little token of our appreciation, but it's on the other side of the stage. Oh. Now, that would never have happened in one of your screenplays.
Should I follow into the dark? Oh, thank you. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Oh.
I don't know if you have that already. That's our cookbook. I don't know if you have that.
No.